This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. Mampila Rampili is known in her native South Africa as a feminist role model of both the apartheid and post-apartheid eras. She was among the first women to get a medical degree in her country. As an activist against apartheid in the 70s, she was banished to a remote village where she built self-help clinics that still thrive today. As an academic, she became one of South Africa's foremost anthropologists of rural poverty. In 1996, Mampila Rampili was named president of the University of Cape Town, making her the first Black African woman to head a university in South Africa. Rampili is also a single mother of two children, one of whom bears the name of her longtime lover, the political activist Stephen Biko. Biko was murdered in detention in 1977 by South African police. He was the founder of the Black Consciousness Movement, which was dedicated to ending racial oppression. In her new memoir, Across Boundaries, Mampila Rampili describes her relationship with Stephen Biko and the philosophy of Black consciousness.
It was really quite an interesting movement that focused on an analysis of how does it happen that the majority in South Africa, which is Black, can actually be kept down so effectively and efficiently by a minority. And it's in understanding that and being influenced by the wave of student protests, which started in France and in this country as well, that we began to raise the question as young people and as young Black people about what would really make a difference. And there was also the wave of the Black Power movement in this country and the Negritude movement in Africa, particularly in West Africa. And that really opened our minds to understanding that oppression had two elements to it. There was the physical oppression of a big, mighty state that keeps you in your place. But there was also the equally powerful psychological oppression, which really became embedded in one. And if one didn't believe in oneself, if one believed that, in fact, being treated as an inferior person made you inferior, and if you believed in that inferiority, then there was no chance of actually ever freeing oneself from oppression. So the focus of the Black Consciousness Movement was in liberating Black people from the psychological oppression of feeling inferior.
And how did people respond to you? Did they want their consciousnesses raised?
Well, at the beginning, people were very frightened because you must remember that this was in the late 60s, early 70s, after the massive clampdown by the South African government on the ANC and the PAC. And people were absolutely terrified of being seen to be involved in anything political. And so the impact of the Black Consciousness Movement was very slow in coming. But when it did, because it spoke to what people really cared about, which is themselves, their own self-image, then you had that surge of energy that was largely amongst the youth, but also permeated into the adult world in the form of non-governmental organizations, church groups, and you had people raising their fists for the first time and saying, if we unite, we will be able to overcome the oppression that keeps us down.
You worked closely with Stephen Biko at this time. He was married to someone else. You had married someone else, and then your marriage had fallen apart. You were divorced. You became pregnant with Stephen Biko's child. Had you planned the pregnancy?
Not really, but it's one of those things that happened subconsciously, that you want it, you don't want it. Because not wanting to be controversial, because it's very complicated to have a married man's child, but being so deeply in love, you do want to share something larger than just the two of you. So yes and no, it was planned and unplanned.
The baby died, I think, was she just over 2 months old?
Mm-hmm.
What did she die of?
Pneumonia. Viral pneumonia, which was very sad for me. But it's one of those things that also reflects the poor health services in the rural areas, because the baby was left with my mum, And it was very difficult for my mother to get the child to a hospital. And when they finally got there, there wasn't a pediatrician. There wasn't anybody other than a nurse. And so there was really no chance for the baby.
It's so painful to lose a child, especially so young. I'm thinking your relationship was such a, was still a secret then. Did you have to grieve alone in secret?
It wasn't secret. I mean, the point is that our relationship was a public secret, if you see what I mean. Everybody knew about it, including his partner or his wife. Because it was something that really was beyond our power to keep under control, because I had, by marrying somebody else, actually tried to deny the depth of that relationship. And when it became quite... In fact, the reason why my marriage broke down is because my husband could never trust that I wasn't in love with this man anymore. So it was really a relationship which had a momentum of its own. And I don't think that it was unstoppable. I don't think it could have been stopped in an interesting way.
After the Soweto riots in 1976, there was a police crackdown on activists. How did you first feel the crackdown?
It first occurred around one's friends getting detained. And in fact, a very close member of our community was killed in detention, Mapetla Mohapi. And I had the unenviable task of attending his postmortem. It was, in fact, on the night of our planning to go to his funeral the following day that I was detained. And so the whole wave of detention without trial was increased from August 1976 until the end of that year. But I was fortunate to be detained not for interrogation, but for what they call preventive detention.
What does that mean?
That meant that you were simply made, as my kids would say, chill out in jail. You had no contact with the outside world except the monitored visits. And you sat there until it pleased them to release you.
I believe your brother, who was only 14, was also arrested at the time. Were they trying to get at you through your brother or get at Stephen Biko through your family?
They were trying to get at Stephen Biko because they beat those little boys to smithereens to the point where they were so swollen that they couldn't get into their pants. And the whole purpose was to try and find out from them who Steve Biko sees and whether or not he's involved in activities which were proscribed in terms of his banning order.
My guest is Dr. Mampila Rampili. She is the president of the University of Cape Town and the first black woman to head a university in South Africa. Mampila Rampili is a physician and an anthropologist. She was a longtime healthcare and political activist against apartheid. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Mampila Rampili. She's the president of the University of Cape Town. She worked as an activist with the Black Consciousness Movement led by Stephen Biko during apartheid. You were arrested again shortly after you were detained for a short time. You were banned to the Northern Transvaal. Did you know the area of the country where you were going?
Not at all. But when I got to this place, I was put up in a hospital because through some twisted logic, they actually thought that I would accept a job as a medical doctor in this remote village hospital. Unfortunately, the person who received me at the hospital was a schoolmate of mine. And so she helped me to contact the Catholic Church the following day and got the Catholic priest to put me in contact with Steve. And so when I finally got through to him, I just cried. I was just so frustrated and angry. But that's the old South Africa.
Now, in the rush to banish you, the police and the authorities apparently didn't dot all their I's, and a lawyer got you back home on a technicality, only to have you banished back to the Transvaal shortly thereafter. Did you know by the time you got get back to your banishment that you were pregnant again with Stephen Biko's child?
No, I didn't know until I think that was in April, and I only got to know that I was pregnant late in May, early June. Because in the manner in which I left King Williamstown, there was no time for me to take my pills, which I was using at the time, because we had planned not to have another child until he had sorted out his marriage. And so we didn't want to raise any further eyebrows by having another child. But because I left in a rush, going back to King Williamstown 10 days later, it was inevitable that with the passion, there would be a product. And thank God that there was.
You were in the hospital with problems with the pregnancy when Stephen Biko was arrested again and underwent the interrogation which ended his life in 1977. Did you know how he died?
I knew exactly. I mean, after I calmed down and heard that he had died in detention, I knew that they would have tried to humiliate him and he wouldn't let them, and that they would all try to pin him down. And in the process, they would hurt him. I knew. So I don't have to go through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to know how he died. I knew exactly how he died.
What did you tell your son early
on? Well, it took me 4 years to tell him that actually his father is dead. And it's funny with children, because I'm sure he knew that something was wrong. So the minute I told him, he said, "Ach, shem, Mom," and gave me a big hug and ran off to go and play. It must have been a moment of relief for him. And we are very close. And he has gone through life, obviously, very deprived, not having a father. But we have an open relationship that we talk through these issues.
My guest is Dr. Mampila Rampili. She's the president of the University of Cape Town and the first black woman to head a university in South Africa. She was a longtime healthcare and political activist against apartheid and in the post-apartheid period. When your banishment was lifted in 1983, you went back to the Cape, and you lived in Cape Town during really, to put it mildly, chaotic times. How did the high crime rate, the chaos, and the political unrest intrude on your family? What was life like in the 80s there?
It was truly one of the darkest hours of South Africa, because not only was one contending with the harassment by police and the brutality of their methods and the fact that they had their armored cars parked outside of the house which we were renting. And any time you could have a burst of fire going either directed at fleeing youths, or in one instance, they actually blew a huge hole through the roof, and we only noticed it when it rained and water just started pouring down. But also one had to contend with youth that were intimidating people. And that youth who behaved in the most dreadful way. And so one was caught between the brutal police and the equally ill-disciplined youth. It was a terrible time, because what worried me most was how out of that chaos we were going to be able to build a society that would have any measure of discipline, any measure of a sense of respect for itself, and for other people.
You wrote a book at the time for UNICEF called Children on the Frontline about how South African children are affected by the violence on both sides of the apartheid line. And you were criticized for your analysis of Black South Africans' violence and how it's shaping these children's lives. What did the Black activist community object to in your analysis of children in violence?
Well, they objected to the fact that I was saying, even though the system is brutal, even though the police are brutal, there is no excuse for us as Black people turning the anger against the self and letting young people be the executioners and having young people actually humiliate their parents and adults. Because my concern, as I said to them, was that in the end, we are going to have to live with these young people in the post-apartheid South Africa. And they are not going to be able to know what is right and what is wrong. And so the criticism was that I was blaming the victim. And I said, if we treat ourselves as victims, we will be victims. We've got to go beyond just simply being survivors of a bad system, but also historical agents, so that our liberation process must also have within it the seeds of the new South Africa.
You describe a great irony about your life at that time, which is that in all of this chaos, when you'd go to work, your life was very calm and peaceful and normal. Is that how you explain to yourself how many South Africans and white South Africans came to believe that there wasn't so much wrong with society under apartheid? If you never see the Black townships, then how do you know?
Absolutely. And sadly, that not wanting to know continues to date, because white South Africa and increasingly the upper and middle class Black people who have moved into the suburbs. You can literally live in Cape Town, in Camps Bay, and see nothing but the beauty of the sunsets and the sunrises and the beauty of the forest, the mountain, and not have to deal with the fact that the school system in Guguletu and Nyanga and all the Black townships is in a state of chaos. You don't have to deal with that. And this is the real success of apartheid. It has successfully created a division or divisions that insulate those who have from the have-nots. And so if we are not very careful in South Africa, we will have class replacing race as a definer of opportunities. But even having said that, the majority of poor people will be Black people. And so we really do need to constantly remind ourselves that the leafy suburbs of Cape Town are just 10 kilometers away from the dust and the chaos and the crime-ridden Guguletus of this day.
Dr. Rompili, do you still see in your work with young people as president of the University of Cape Town a Black consciousness problem in South Africa, that's the legacy of apartheid, that Blacks and young Blacks still believe that they are truly inferior, still believe the line they were fed?
Indeed. And that's part of the criticism that I get from a lot of white people. It's because there is, underlying that criticism, a belief that if something is not white and male, it must be substandard. And so I have to be very clear that our vision as a university to be a world-class African university is a conscious decision, which is not a kind of media hype, but that we know that there are elements within the university which are world-class, but there are others that are not up to scratch, and we're going to attend to that. And so I turn around to the Black students and say to them, for as long as they believe they are inferior, they are not going to take ownership of a university like Cape Town. They are going to constantly react negatively for their own benefit to this underlying white racism, which still exists in South Africa. So I have to work very closely with young Black students, particularly the student leadership, to ask them and to encourage them to really examine their own consciences. Because if they liberate themselves from that inferiority complex inside, then it becomes less easy for the bigotry, whether it be racism or sexism, to get at them. And I believe that in the country as a whole, there is still a big job to be done. Because how do you explain to young black people why the poorest people, the less educated, the least educated people, the people who are entangled in the most violence and the most crime are black people? Unless, you know, there is an explanation to them that places that whole analysis in context, they're going to run the risk of believing that there's something wrong with black people.
Mampila Rampili is the president of the University of Cape Town. Her memoir is Across Boundaries.